So, all right, today I'm going to tell you about a perspective on causal dynamical triangulations in 3 plus 1 vignettes. Okay, so let me just start off with a little bit of introduction about causal dynamical triangulations. All right, so I think a nice setting in which to think about causal dynamical triangulations, right, is basically trying to construct quantum gravity as a quantum field theory. All right. So the question we'd like to ask is, or the question we ask is, right, will the quantum theory of gravity prove to be yet another triumph of the paradigm of the quantum theory of fields? Obviously, we don't know the answer yet, but we might as well keep trying because quantum theory of fields works pretty well. Okay, so I'd like to point out a few familiar facts to keep in mind when we're doing this. Right, one is, of course, that Einstein gravity is perturbatively non-normalizable. Right. The second one is that even so, right, we can still use perturbative quantum Einstein gravity as an effective field theory to make universal predictions. Right. The problem, though, is that when we do that, the predictions we make, right, we get effects that are basically set by the Planck length. And so these effects are extremely small and unlikely to be seen in experiments in the near future. Right. So there are a lot of ways we could respond to these facts and some other ideas. So I want to point out a few of them. Right. One thing we could do, which has long been popular, is to look at modified theories of gravity, which might be perturbatively renormalizable. Another possibility is that Einstein gravity is non-perturbatively renormalizable. And in particular, it might be asymptotically safe, like Weinberg suggested. And of course, another response would just be, we should give up on trying to construct quantum gravity as a quantum field theory and look at some other approaches. Okay, so I'm basically going to look at the second idea to try to construct a quantum theory of gravity that's non-perturbatively renormalizable. And I'd say there are sort of two main techniques.
It's not worth taking time out, but let me just note a descent. Loop quantum gravity is a quantum field theory.
Okay.
It's a quantum theory of location tension. So I think it falls squarely in the paradigm of gauge quantum field theory.
Okay.
Anyway, it's not worth
taking. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. So there are basically sort of two techniques that are being used to investigate this sort of asymptotic safety scenario. One that's very popular at the moment is to use the exact renormalization group. I would say the more established technique is to use a lattice regularization. And causal dynamical triangulations is the latest incarnation in a series of attempts to use lattice regularization to non-perturbatively define a quantum theory of gravity. Okay, so right, what is causal dynamical triangulations? Right. Well, basically, it gives a prescription for making sense of the gravitational path integral. All right. So how does this prescription work? Well, the idea is let's just use standard lattice quantum field theoretic techniques like you would use in quantum chromodynamics, for instance, right? That's the idea. So the prescription goes as follows, right? The first thing we need to do is sort of make the key hypothesis for the approach for causal dynamical triangulations. And this is we're gonna restrict what space-times are allowed to enter the path integral, right? And we're only gonna allow what you might call causal space-times to enter. And these are space-times that admit a global foliation by space-like hypersurfaces that all have the same topology. So if you have misgivings about causal dynamical triangulations, it's probably because of this sort of key hypothesis. And I would say it's fine to have misgivings, I have them myself. But I think what we should really do is, we can take this hypothesis and see where it leads us and then judge it at the end, right? Okay. All right, so once we make that hypothesis, now the idea is just to use these standard field theoretic techniques of lattice regularization, right? So we're going to regularize these sort of causal space times by causal triangulations, right? So a causal triangulation is just a piecewise Minkowski simplicial manifold that has this foliation structure, right? So if you were in 1+1 dimensions, locally a causal triangulation would look kind of like this. You have these blue space-like hypersurfaces, and it's just formed by line segments. And then there are these red line segments, which are time-like, which connect up the adjacent leaves of the foliation. Similarly, in 2+1 dimensions, now each leaf of the foliation is triangulated by equilateral triangles, and you have these time-like links, which form three simplices connecting adjacent leaves of the foliation. And then similarly, in 3+1 dimension, you have these four simplices, which it's hard to draw how they come together, but in a similar way to get these sort of layered structures. And the one thing I want to note is that we introduce a relative scaling by this parameter alpha between the time-like and the space-like links. And I'll tell you where that comes in a moment. Okay. Right, so we've regularized these causal space times, right? And that basically just means we're going to take the formal path integral, right, an amplitude given some boundary data, right, where you would integrate over all space times that have the right boundary conditions and have the chosen topology for the slice, the leaves of the foliation. Right, we're going to replace this amplitude by this concrete path sum, right, where we compute this path sum by summing over all causal triangulations that have a particular boundary condition and that have the topology for the leaves of the chosen topology for the leaves of the foliation. And then we have a measure, which is just the inverse of the automorphism group of the triangulation and the exponential of I times the action written in the Regi calculus of causal triangulations. All right. So the idea then is to compute the path sum and to take the continuum limit if it exists. All right. So I probably should have called this slide causal dynamical triangulations in theory, because when we get to steps 4 and 5, we run into difficulties, right? We don't know how to compute these path sums analytically. So what we actually do in practice is, right, we still do those first three steps, but now we do a Wick rotation of this path sum to the Euclidean domain so that we end up with a partition function. And there's a very nice Wick rotation, which is just based on this scaling parameter alpha. Right. So now that we have a partition function, right, we can run Monte Carlo simulations of representative causal triangulations contributing to that partition function. Then what we'd like to do is Wick rotate back to the Lorentzian domain, and then, right, try to take a continuum limit if it exists, right? So at the moment, we're sort of stuck at number 5, right? We can certainly run these simulations. We have very little idea about Wick rotating back to the Lorentzian domain, and we're only just beginning to understand whether or not there might be a continuum limit. Okay. So now I just want to go through what I think are the sort of the three key results of the approach, and then these will be useful background for the 3+1 vignettes that I'll talk about afterwards. Okay. So I think the first key result is basically the phase structure that we get, right? So if we use causal dynamical triangulation to quantize 3+1 dimensional Einstein gravity with a positive bare cosmological constant, and if we take the leaves of the triangulation to be three spheres, and for convenience, we compactify the time direction. In that case, what we find is that there are three phases, A, B, and C, of the quantum geometry. So there's a first order transition between phases A and C, and there's a second order transition between phases B and C. That fact is quite nice because typically you need a second order transition in order to define a continuum limit if you can find an ultraviolet fixed point on that second order transition. What are the parameters? Yeah, sorry. So the parameters are these delta and kappa naught. So When you write down the action in this particular case, there are three parameters, basically. One of them you have to tune in order to run the simulations. And then you're left with two that you can arbitrarily choose. So this one is closely related to the alpha parameter that scales the space-like relative to the time-like links. So if delta is zero, that means alpha is one, and you have the time-like and space-like links have the same length. And then this one is closely related to Newton's constant, the Baire-Newton constant. So what are these three phases like? So one way to get a handle on what they're like is to take a representative causal triangulation from one of the phases and basically to measure how much volume you have as a function of a discrete time coordinate just labeling the leaves in the foliation. So in phase A, what you find is that the leaves of the foliation are sort of decoupled. In phase B, what you find is that you sort of have a crumpled behavior where all of the volume accumulates over one or two leaves of the foliation. But then in phase C, what you find is that you have sort of a nice distribution of volume over a nice proportion of the leaves in the foliation, and then you have these little stalks outside. So phase C, as we'll see in the next couple slides, is the one that appears to have physical properties. So basically, I'm going to concentrate on phase C for essentially the rest of the talk.
Yep. Is there a way to physically think about the alpha parameter? Because if I have to tune it to go to the transition, and there is a physical picture of it.
So I would say at the moment, we don't have a physical understanding for what the alpha parameter means.
Isn't there such a parameter in OHAVA or Givaliti, more of a picture? When you break Lorentz invariants, then you have such a
parameter. Yeah, so there is a parameter in Horjava-Lifshitz, this what's often written as little lambda, lowercase lambda, which people would like to sort of identify with this alpha parameter. But I don't think there's any real hard evidence that you can directly relate them.
It's more in this breaking.
Possibly. I mean, in causal dynamical triangulations, right, what you'd really want to do is, right, if you can find a continuum limit, you would then ask, you know, is Lorentz invariance broken in the continuum limit or not? I mean, so clearly it's broken before you take the continuum limit, but it's not clear to me that just because if this alpha parameter is turned on, it's not clear to me that the continuum limit, if there is one, necessarily breaks Lorentz invariance, but I don't know.
Transition seems safe because it looks like it's a constant alpha.
Close to.
But the A, C, clearly, I mean, since you don't have such a parameter in physics, so, you know,
right.
Any line that is not parallel to alpha or constant or some combination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, is not going to be a good candidate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So the second key result is about the classical limit. Right. So what you can do is you can, those graphs I showed you just before are showing you the spatial volume as a function of the time coordinate labeling the leaves in the foliation. So you can ask, is there an effective action for the spatial volume as a function of this time coordinate in phase C? And you can just try to directly measure the effective action, and this is the basic result you get. So you have a kinetic term here, right? This is a derivative. You have a potential term, and then you have sort of a cosmological constant term. And this effective action looks a lot like just this particular action. This is just, I take the Einstein-Hilbert action in Euclidean signature, and I make a mini superspace approximation, and instead of writing things in terms of the scale factor, I just write things in terms of the three volume. Okay. The one thing that's different is that in Euclidean signature, you'd usually have a minus sign out in front. And you actually find that that's absent in this case, so that the kinetic term appears to have the correct sign. All right. So that's nice. So let's look at this plot, right? So again, we're showing the volume as a function of the label for the leaves of the foliation, right? The blue dots here are some numerical data, right? This is basically the ensemble average or the one-point function of the volume. And what I've done is I've, within, from here to here, in what's sort of the physical part of the universe, I've done a fit to Euclidean de Sitter, right? So Euclidean de Sitter has this particular volume profile, and it's the extrema of this action, right? So I just sort of finite size scale this, and I can fit it with one parameter S naught, and I get a pretty nice fit. Okay. So the second part of the sort of classical limit is maybe sort of a semi-classical part. And what you can do is you can now look at the fluctuations in the volume away from the ensemble average. All right. So in particular, what we do is we measure this two-point function, the connected two-point function of the fluctuations in the volume away from the ensemble average. And what you find from measurements is that this takes a particular form. So you have a constant, this gamma squared. You have the number of force simplices that you're using to construct each of your causal triangulations. And then you have this universal scaling function, which just has the scaled, the finite size scaled time labeling leaves of the foliation. Okay. So you can try to model this two-point function. And the idea for modeling it is to take the effective action that we had on the previous page, the Einstein-Hilbert effective action, and basically just expand to second order in fluctuations around Euclidean de Sitter, right? And then you can compute that two-point function in the standard way. If you assume this model, then this parameter gamma is basically related to the product of Newton's constant and the cosmological constant. All right, so how well does that model work? Well, here's some data. So what we've done is we've taken the measured two-point function of these fluctuations, and we've decomposed it into the eigenvectors and the eigenvalues, right? So again, the blue dots are the numerical data. These are the first six eigenvectors and all of the eigenvalues. And then we've done fits of this model to those eigenvectors and eigenvalues, right? And you get quite nice agreement for the first few eigenvectors, and then it starts to not be so great, but that's more or less as you expect, because you expect this model to work better for the larger scale eigenvectors. And the eigenvalue fits are also pretty good, I would say. Okay. All right, so the third key result is sort of a novel quantum mechanical effect that you get out. And the idea behind this is to consider the diffusion of a random walk, a test random walker on a causal triangulation, right? So this is just the diffusion equation that you'd write down on a causal triangulation. And this is the heat kernel, which gives you the probability of diffusing from one simplex to another simplex in sigma plus one time steps, right? So sigma is the diffusion time. So what we look at is the return probability, which is just, right, the probability of starting at one simplex, doing a walk of sigma steps, and returning to that simplex. Right? And we just average it over the triangulation. From that, we then define the spectral dimension as just this particular logarithmic derivative of the return probability. So you're basically asking, how does the return probability scale with the diffusion time? The motivation for this definition, which gives you sort of an effective measure of the dimensionality of the space-time, is that if you compute the return probability on flat space-time, for instance, this definition precisely gives you back the topological dimension of flat space-time. All right. So we can measure this on an ensemble of causal triangulations. So this is some data from Benedetti and Henson in 2+1 dimensions. What you find is that on short diffusion times, it goes up, it peaks at approximately 3, which is the topological dimension here, and then it exponentially falls off. So that it peak, the fact that it peaks around 3 is nice because that's the sort of the classical dimension. This fall off is just because we're looking at causal triangulations who have two spheres for the leaves of their foliations. So we have positive curvature, and that leads to this fall off. And in fact, the green is a fit of the fall off essentially to Euclidean De Sitter space. Okay. So if we focus in now on very short diffusion times to the left of the peak, what we find is this behavior, right? So the peak is out over here at about 3. If we then go to smaller diffusion times, which is supposed to be like smaller scales, right, we see that the spectral dimension decreases to a value that's been extrapolated to be around 2.
Is it a lattice artifact, or because you have a small scale, you know that the continuum means? How can you trust that?
How can you trust that?
I mean,
so
you read?
Yes.
You're the, I mean, there's a point where you know you're,
yeah,
you know, whatever phenomenon you're going to see is a purely lattice artifact.
Yeah, so that, well, so you could actually see, there's definitely lattice artifacts for very short diffusion times. You can see these points that sort of go up and down. I mean, that's definitely a lattice artifact that has to do with the even and odd length random walks giving you very different measures for, right, giving you very different measures for the spectral dimension. But you can do a finite size scaling analysis where you increase the number of simplices that you're using, and you you still find that you get the, I mean, I wouldn't say it's absolutely conclusive, but right, as you increase the number of simplices, you still find that you get this dynamical reduction in the dimension.
The 3D simplices, how many do you put?
So this particular data is at 70,000. Yeah. So you can also do this in 3+1 dimensions, and you get something similar. Again, originally this was extrapolated to a value of about 2 at, you know, 0 diffusion time. But there's a very new paper by Kuhn and Yurkovich, which suggests that actually the value is more close to 3/2. All right.
Mm-hmm. Why you do the functional derivative for the source? What is your source term to gather 2-point function?
What is?
So you gather 2-point function by taking derivative, functional derivative to the source term.
Well, we're, I mean, so I guess the source term is you're taking this effective action, mm-hmm, and you're expanding it to second order in these perturbations. So in a sense, you're taking a perturbation of the 3 volume around the 3 volume of Euclidean De Sitter. So in a sense, the source term is the terms that involve this fluctuation, I would say. All right. So with that, I'd like to move on to the first vignette, which is about renormalization group flows. In particular, right, we're interested in constructing renormalization group flows because we'd like to explore whether or not causal dynamical triangulations admits a continuum limit, right? So I could really give a whole talk on this topic, but in a sense it wouldn't be very interesting because at the moment it's not very conclusive what our studies have shown. So instead, I was going to keep this first vignette quite brief. And what I want to do is just, first I want to point out sort of two, I think, sort of interesting ideas about how we extract renormalization group flows from lattice data, okay? So the first thing is about how we can even delineate what we mean or define what we mean by a renormalization group trajectory, okay? So let's just suppose, for the moment, that we have an ensemble of causal triangulations that we've generated using Monte Carlo techniques. And let's just suppose that the physics in that ensemble, basically gives us information on a range of scales between some UV scale and some IR scale. Okay. Right. So let's now say that we measure some observable O at the length scale L between those two scales. Right. Now let's suppose that we can implement our normalization group transformation. And I'm going to take this transformation to sort of just integrate out some small scale degrees of freedom. So the UV scale is going to get a little bit larger. I'm going to keep fixed the IR scale. So now what I'm going to do is, I'm going to do a measurement of this observable at the scale L. All right. What I should find is that these two measurements must agree on the value of this observable. Right. So the renormalization group transformation, which takes me along the trajectory, right, it doesn't change the value of this observable. Right. So what people often say is that in that sense, along a renormalization group trajectory, physics is constant. That's often the way people phrase it. Okay. So the idea then is we have some lattice data. We need to be able to find a whole bunch of observables that we can use. And in order to define what we mean by renormalization group trajectories, by having the physics of those observables remain constant along the trajectory. That's the idea. Okay. All right, so now how might we actually implement this renormalization group transformation, right? So the standard way when you're working on a lattice is just to do a coarse graining, right? So you start with some ensemble of causal triangulations and you just repeatedly coarse grain each of the causal triangulations in that ensemble. And after each coarse graining, you study the new coarse grained ensemble of causal triangulations. That would be sort of the standard way. But there's another way to go about this, which I think is quite nice. And the idea is, instead of trying to invent a coarse grading scheme that works well, why not just directly generate ensembles of causal triangulations that are characterized by different ranges of scales? And the idea is you have a bunch of control parameters, right? T is the number of leaves of your foliation, N4 is the number of simplices, and then you have these two parameters in your bare action. Right? So you can just vary those, go to different places in phase C, and what you'll get is you'll get ensembles that happen to be characterized by different ranges of scales. Then the idea is you look at the physics of observables in those ensembles, and you sort of string them together to form renormalization group trajectories. That's the idea. Okay. All right. So I just want to finish this vignette by giving you sort of a little status report on renormalization group analyses that have actually been done in causal dynamical triangulations. All right. So first I'm going to talk about very briefly about the renormalization group scheme that I've proposed. So the idea of my scheme is to really try to stick to the sort of the key results that we definitely know hold, right, that I talked about previously, right? So the model I'm going to use to interpret the numerical data is the model I talked about before. It's just this mini superspace approximation of the Euclidean Einstein-Hilbert action. And I'm going to take Euclidean to Sitter space as my ground state. So what observables, which we would use to define the renormalization group trajectories, what observables do we know in the context of this model? Unfortunately, we know very few. Right? We know we can essentially measure the four volume. We know how to extract this dimensionless product of the Newton and the cosmological constants. And we can measure the spectral dimension. That's about all we know, unfortunately. Okay, so these other things that we measured, I wouldn't really consider to be actually physical observables with respect to this model because they depend on a choice of coordinates. So if you take what we know, what we definitely know about phase C, what you find is that you really don't have enough information to do a renormalization group analysis yet. That's unfortunately the conclusion. Okay.
To go back to the spectral dimension, sure, you need to look at the probability to come back to the same point.
Yeah.
But if your triangulation is changing in time, how do you say that you are actually coming back to the same point? Somehow.
So I don't think of the causal triangulation changing with time. I mean, right? We have, each triangulation is just a fixed. The thing you simulate is a fixed. Each one is a fixed Euclidean triangulation, right?
Okay.
So, you know all of the adjacencies of all the simplices that go into each
Euclidean,
one.
You're not looking in time,
right?
So why
you're Yeah, so you're just looking at paths that go through, that go from simplex to simplex,
and come back to the very same one.
And come back to the very same one. Yeah.
So there would be closed time-like loops in algebraic rotation.
Yeah, I mean, well, or at least you would consider
space-like.
Yeah, you would consider loops that, yeah, in some sense, would be. Might think of as closed time-like loops.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so there's also in the literature a renormalization group analysis by Ambjorn et al. And they do things a little bit differently, mostly because of this last fact, which is that we don't really have enough information at the moment to do a renormalization group analysis just in these terms, right? So what they do is they take as their model a mini superspace approximation of a particular Poujava-Lifshitz action. And as the ground state, they take a deformation of Euclidean de Sitter space, which is basically the stretched sphere. So what this lets them do is, for observables of this model, they're basically able to elevate these other things we can measure to observables, because they can give a physical meaning to this particular choice of coordinates. That's the idea. All right. But even that is not enough, and they have to make a further assumption. And what they do is they assume that the lattice spacing is constant in some sense, all for all parameter values within phase C. Okay. When they make this further assumption, what they can then do is make a tentative argument for a scenario in which there is perhaps an ultraviolet fixed point along this second order phase transition. So what do I mean? First of all, I should say I think this assumption is really not well motivated at all. In the context of a quantum theory of gravity, I think, you know, the lattice spacing, if you want to assign any meaning to the lattice spacing, you should sort of measure the lattice spacing in units of something that you would call an observable. What they're basically doing is, I would say they're not doing that, right? They're just assuming that they can say the lattice spacing in some sense serves as a unit of measure, and they're just going to take that as a fixed unit of measure for wherever they happen to be in phase C.
So when you vary K, you could think of varying the lattice space. That's what they think, is that?
Yeah.
And I think that varying the lattice, yeah.
Yeah, so you might, yeah. So
varying K is like varying the lattice spacing?
I would generally think that if you vary, say, this coupling constant kappa, that if you measure the lattice spacing at different values of kappa in units of something physical, you would find different values for the lattice spacing. As far as I understand what they're doing, they're not doing that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But more on different kappa would be,
yeah,
if you have the algebraic equation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I should also say that I mean, assuming this model, I don't think it's not that it's unmotivated, but it's. I don't think there's really any very concrete numerical data that favors this model over just the model using the Einstein-Hilbert action, at least in 3+1 dimensions.
Sure.
In that sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'd be happy to talk more about renormalization group analysis and causal dynamical triangulations But for the moment, I'm going to move on. Okay. All right. So the second vignette is about measuring the homogeneity of the quantum geometry in phase C of causal dynamical triangulations. All right. So why might you be interested in measuring the homogeneity? Well, as I was sort of just saying, right, we really don't have very many physical observables, right? So homogeneity is sort of a very intuitive thing to try to measure, and you might be able to define some measure of homogeneity that's well-defined in a continuum limit, right? The very far-fetched motivation is that you would like your quantum theory of gravity to predict the spectrum of the primordial cosmological perturbations. And understanding something about homogeneity is sort of a very preliminary first step in that direction. All right. So in defining these measures of homogeneity, in part I've taken some inspiration from techniques that are used to measure the homogeneity of our own universe on the basis of galaxy redshift surveys. So what I'm going to do is define two different measures of the homogeneity, and I'm going to apply each of those in two different ways, right? So first of all, I'm going to measure the homogeneity of the entire quantum spacetime geometry. And then I'm going to do what people do with galaxy redshift surveys, which is to measure basically the epoch dependence of homogeneity, right? So I'll look at the temporal evolution in the distinguished foliation of the triangulation, and I'll ask how the homogeneity evolves in that foliation. All right. So the first measure I'm going to define is a volumetric measure. So let's look at this two-dimensional triangulation, and let's focus on this particular simplex. Okay. So I've just color-coded the nearest neighbors, the next nearest neighbors, the next nearest neighbors, and so forth. Right. So as a function of the graph geodesic distance away from that simplex, I can just count the number of neighbors at that graph geodesic distance, right? That's pretty straightforward. Okay. So now I'm just going to define the normalized number of simplices within a graph geodesic distance R, right? So I'm just going to sum, you know, within some distance R, all of the numbers of neighbors within that distance R. Okay. So then I can just define the mean and the variance in the number of simplices within a graph geodesic distance R, right, the mean and the variance over all the simplices in a triangulation. So the mean is related to a particular definition of the Hausdorff dimension, right? Basically, how the mean scales with the graph geodesic distance R is telling you about the Hausdorff dimension. My homogeneity measure is instead related to the variance. Okay, so it's just going to be the expectation value of the variance in the quantum state defined by causal triangulations. So the idea behind this definition is very straightforward, right? The variance just tells you how much this quantity, the number of simplices within a graph geodesic distance, how much that varies from simplex to simplex in the causal triangulation, right? So in that sense, it measures, you know, how much this point in the triangulation is like this other point in the triangulation. That's the idea. All right. So if we then go and measure this, let's see what we find. So the first thing I'm going to show you is a finite size scaling analysis of this volumetric homogeneity measure applied to the whole quantum space-time geometry in phase C. All right. So this is in 2+1 dimensions, right? And right again, the leaves of the foliation are two spheres, and this is at a fixed value of the coupling. All right. So I have three different ensembles characterized by increasing numbers of simplices. Okay. And what I'm plotting here is the homogeneity measure, right? So if it's different, if it's greater than zero, that means there's inhomogeneity. And this is the finite size scaled graph geodesic distance.
Space inhomogeneity or time inhomogeneity, or space?
Just I don't distinguish in this case.
Because you have a foliation, so you can.
True. So
you have two measures of homogeneity.
Right. Yeah. So in this, but in this case, I'm not distinguishing.
But can you, in principle?
Yeah, definitely.
You haven't done.
So what I have done is I'll show you in a moment, is to measure the just the spatial homogeneity and look at it at different times. I'll show you that. Okay. So what this finite size scaling analysis unfortunately seems to show is that this particular homogeneity measure is probably not very well defined, right? Because if you look at the peak of the homogeneity, the peak gets progressively higher as you increase the number of three simplices. Right? So that suggests in the thermodynamic limit that this is just going to diverge, and that in that sense, this homogeneity measure is not so useful. It could be that in a continuum limit where you also took the lattice spacing to zero, you might find something non-trivial, but I don't know.
So that when you take the continuum limit, you're really generating a very highly non-homogeneous manifold. Isn't that another interpretation?
If you just take the limit where the number of simplices goes to infinity, right, it's saying that in some sense you're becoming more and more inhomogeneous.
Yes.
Right.
That would mean that your continuum manifold is not homogeneous. So, that you're not reaching the continuum. I'm trying to say it's a problem with the measure you use, but it might be a feature of the space-time you're probing.
Yeah, I guess you could interpret it that way.
Think one way or the other. Are you thinking that your guy is homogeneous and I have to, because that's a question you're asking, is that guy homogeneous or not? And
mm-hmm.
If your measure tells you it is not, then why are you telling me, it means my measure is not correct?
Okay. I guess, yeah, so I guess I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, it could be that there's nothing wrong with the measure, and that, yeah, in the thermodynamic limit, it's simply that the geometries are becoming more and more inhomogeneous. That's true. I guess I was thinking that, you know, if it's some well-defined quantity, it should remain finite. But that's not.
That's essentially the whole question. Do we, you know, by doing this procedure, do we get?
Right. Do we get something? Yeah. But. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or do we get some other?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, like I was saying, we can also apply this measure of the homogeneity. Right. What we can do is we can look at the spatial homogeneity at different times. Right. So I've taken six different leaves of the foliation that are labeled in these different colors. And I've just measured the homogeneity at each of them, right? So the homogeneity just concentrate on the darker curve. So these all have the same shape as the previous graph. And what you find is that the amount, the sort of the peak amount of inhomogeneity increases towards the center and then decreases again. And likewise, the scale on which the inhomogeneity occurs increases as you go towards the center and then decreases again. So,
two quantities are, one is the scale and the other
one is the distance from the center.
Yeah, so one is just how the height of the peak, right?
The height of the peak.
Which is how the maximum amount of inhomogeneity, right? And the peak is getting higher as I move towards the center. Right? And in a sense, that's consistent with the previous finding because the number of simplices in the center is larger, right? But then if we ask, at what value of the graph geodesic distance does the peak occur? That also increases as we go towards the center.
Negative.
No. So you mean here? So this is tau. Sorry.
It's
small. Yeah. This is just as a reference to show you which time slices I'm using. Yeah. Okay. So what you could ask is there some sort of scaling present in either the peak or the typical scale on which the inhomogeneity occurs. And this is what you find, all right? So this is if we put all of them on the same graph. So what I've done is I'm measuring the typical scale on which inhomogeneity occurs just to be the graph geodesic distance at which the peak occurs, okay? So if you do a log-log plot of the typical scale on which the inhomogeneity occurs and the volume of the leaf in the foliation, what you find is that you get very nice power law scaling.
But it means that maybe you should change your notion of distance. That is, you can, suppose it means you can set your distribution so that they all fit together.
Mm-hmm.
But you're changing here, you're assuming that the notion of distance is really this microscopic notion of distance.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
But yeah.
You don't know.
Right.
So maybe a better way is to reverse this analysis and say, okay, what is my proper notion of distance? So that because you were scaling with these guys, really anywhere after, I don't know, you were measuring everything after the scale of homogeneity, then
mm-hmm.
you're sure, at least you're safe.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a regime where you're getting together the continuum. Of course, now you don't get the geometry you wanted in the beginning. But at least you get, no?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what you're...
Yeah, I think that's a nice interpretation. I mean, I should also say, you know, when you, if you look at, you know, if you don't look at this scale, but if you look at, say, the height of the peak,
yeah.
right, then you find that it is not quite power law scaling. And if you looked at the other homogeneity measure I'm going to define, you don't find this nice power law scaling either. But.
So maybe the question I have is,
mm-hmm.
what is the evidence that this naive distance you're using is really the physical distance? Because that's all your interpretation is based on that.
And so by the distance, you mean this basically this discrete time coordinate.
Which is really like a purely quantum, very discrete distance,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is, okay,
yeah.
it's natural to use it as a measure, but how, you know, there's still a question, how does that guy relate to how, you know, an observer, you know,
right.
we measure that.
Yeah.
You kind of, the whole discussion is framed into the case that they are the same,
mm-hmm.
and it seems it's not questioned.
Mm-hmm.
But
I mean, so I think what we know is that that this discrete time coordinate is in some sense proportional to the global time coordinate that you use in De Sitter. I think that's the most that we know.
Well, we don't look at the inhomogeneity. I mean, what about the R?
Oh, so the yeah, so the graph geodesic distance.
Well, that's the one you. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I don't think we really, well, I don't think we really know anything about how that is related to some physical distance.
You have the offset dimension depending on the scale.
Right.
And that could be another.
Yeah, so
I mean, there's two ways to understand, the outer dimension, there's two ways to understand that. It's the other to say, are in my physical distance? And my dimension changed, or I got confused on how, you know, that my R should be R squared or whatever. That,
right.
You know, that's,
mm-hmm. Well, so what I didn't point you to, what's plotted in the background of these in the light color is the Hausdorff dimension. And I haven't really studied it very much, but so this is the scale for the Hausdorff dimension. And what you actually have found so far typically is that it, you know, with this sort of naive graph geodesic distance, the Hausdorff dimension really overshoots the topological dimension. So it doesn't, in some sense, it's maybe indicating that this graph geodesic distance is not in some sense a physical distance, but I'm not really sure because I haven't looked too carefully.
Analysis to propose, you know, by demanding universality, for instance, or inhomogeneity, or something like that.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure. Okay. All right. So I also define this spectral measure, it's defined in very much the same way. So I'm going to look at random walks, and I'm just going to look at the variance in the return probability. And then the homogeneity measure is just going to be, right, this expectation value of the variance in the return probability. Right, so I'll just show you one result for that. Right, so again, we're measuring the homogeneity of the entire space-time quantum geometry. And we have these three ensembles with increasing numbers of simplices. Right, so unlike the previous case, what we find here is that there's essentially very little change in the homogeneity measure as we increase the number of three simplices. I'm not quite sure how to interpret that. I'm a little concerned, though, that all of, you know, the place where where there's some inhomogeneity is at very short diffusion times. So I'm a little bit concerned about whether or not it's just a lattice artifact. But I'm not sure at the moment. Yeah, so what's interesting is that the two homogeneity measures seem to indicate inhomogeneity on very different scales, right? So if you did it right, the previous homogeneity measure, right, I looked at a finite size scaled graph geodesic distance, right? And the finite size scaling should really only apply for fairly large scales, and it did work pretty well. So it seems to me that the previous measure was indicating inhomogeneity on a reasonably large, well, a somewhat large scale, whereas here you're getting inhomogeneity on extremely small scales comparatively. So in some sense, there's really a sort of a tension between them because they don't seem to be indicating inhomogeneity on the same regimes, I think.
Can you go back to the definition of this one?
Sure. Oh, sorry.
So it's the variance of
the return probability for one of these random walks.
So somehow it should be related to the variance of the spectral dimension.
Yeah.
In some loose sense.
Yeah. So you could also, I mean, you could equally well define this measure as the variance in the spectral dimension. I just didn't do that because then my statistics would be a lot worse, basically. Yeah. Okay. All right. So the third vignette is about effective actions in 2+1 dimensions. All right. So I should say, first of all, this is mostly work with Jonah Miller, who's here. So let me show you a bunch of transition amplitudes. So this is in 2+1 dimensions. What we're doing, instead of compactifying the time direction, we're just taking it to be an interval, and we're introducing fixed initial and final leaves of the foliation. All right. So here are a bunch of different transition amplitudes. What we're doing is we're fixing the initial and final leaves to be minimal. We're holding fixed the number of three simplices, and we're just varying the number of time slices, right? So in and of themselves, I think these transition amplitudes aren't that interesting, right? You just increase the number of time slices and they flatten out. All right, it's not too interesting at the moment. We can do something else. Which is basically, again, to hold fixed the number of three simplices, now to hold fixed the number of time slices, and just to increase the boundary values, right? How many triangles are going into the boundary triangulations. And again, in and of themselves, these aren't that interesting, except that they don't look at all like Euclidean de Sitter space. And you can ask me about that later if you want. So what I think is somewhat interesting about these is if we do fits of them, to our mini superspace model of either Euclidean de Sitter space in this case or Lorentzian de Sitter space in this case, right? And if you look somewhat closely, you basically see that the fit is not so great, especially at the peak here, and it gradually gets better as you go over to here. Likewise, the fit here is not so great, and it gets better as you go over to here, right? So there seems to be some systematic problem with our fits. So you might worry that we're using the wrong effective action, right? So at the moment, what we're doing is we're trying to basically determine what might be a better effective action to describe these transition amplitudes, right? So I wanted to first mention that there's a nice new paper out by Benedetti and Henson, where they look at precisely this case of 2+1 dimensions, and they provide some evidence that the correct effective action is maybe Hojava-Lipschitz type. And they have a few different lines of evidence. So first of all, they claim that the Hojava-Lipschitz effective action explains what they call space-time condensation, right? So what do they mean by that? If we just go back, what they mean is they just mean this particular profile for the volume as a function of time, right? So can you explain the fact that you get these stalks and then this extended region and then a stalk? What you find is you can't do that in 2+1 dimensions with the Einstein-Hilbert action, but they argue that you can explain this shape if you take a Hojava-Lipschitz type action. They also then do some fits, which I have some issues with, and they propose some scaling relations, which you should be able to test numerically. Right? So with Jonah and a couple of other students, at the moment we're working on basically trying to do a comprehensive statistical analysis where we look at a bunch of different effective actions, Einstein gravity, Hojava-Lipschitz, fourth order gravity. We do fits to the one-point function and the two-point function, and we just let the statistics tell us which is the best description. Okay, so let me very quickly go to the zeroth vignette, which... No, don't have results yet.
We don't know.
Right.
What's your guess?
What's my guess?
Yeah.
Well, I have some preliminary results, and I can get better fits, at least to the one-point function. I haven't looked at the two-point function yet when I use a Hojava-Lipschitz type action. That's about all I have at the moment. Okay. So this zeroth vignette doesn't quite fit with the rest.
How many more parameters do you have in order to measure that?
So you have, so in 2+1 dimensions with projectable case, so one of them isn't relevant. So you have, I guess, just one more parameter. Is that right? No, sorry, two more parameters. Yeah, two more parameters because you introduced this thing we talked about before, which is sort of like the alpha parameter, which breaks Lorentz invariance. And then you have a higher order term, so you have a coefficient for that as well. Yeah, so you have two more parameters.
Can one claim that works better because there is more freedom?
Of course, with more parameters, you're going to get better fits. But then the question is it statistically significant? You know, is it significant statistically? And the preliminary indications are that it is. Yeah. So let me try to quickly go through this. So this is sort of a little suggestion about whether or not we might be able to revive the Euclidean dynamical triangulations approach. And this is work with Frank Zauerzig. Okay, so let's just look at this diagram first, right? So these are renormalization group flows of quantum Einstein gravity in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, where you use background spacetimes that are spherically symmetric. What you see is this is the non-Gaussian fixed point, and then you have a bunch of other fixed points as well. Okay. So the first idea is that we want to take these renormalization group flows and try to generate phase diagrams from them under certain conditions, right? So in particular, I'm going to look at this red line, and I want to generate a phase diagram sort of corresponding to this red line. So what I'm going to do is, right, this red line is at a fixed value for the dimensionless scale-dependent cosmological constant. And in particular, it's between 0 and the value at the non-Gaussian fixed point. And then we're just going to vary g, right, gk, which is the dimensionless scale-dependent Newton constant. Right? So that's varying g along this axis. On this axis, we're going to use as an order parameter the effective action at scale 0, right? So just the regular effective action. Right? So the idea is, right, I move along this line, right, and at some point I pick a renormalization group trajectory that goes through a particular point on this line. And then I want to trace along that renormalization group trajectory down to scale 0 and evaluate the effective action for the spherical background that I've chosen. That's the idea. Okay. So if I do that, I generate a plot that looks kind of like this. Okay. And there's sort of two features of note. There's a divergence here, and then there's a cusp right there. Right. So the cusp we think is maybe a first order transition, and the divergence we think is maybe a second order transition. And so the idea, so these two features occur, the divergence occurs when you get right here, where you cross this trajectory that goes from this fixed point to this fixed point. And when you do that, the trajectories, basically they open up from being spheres at positive cosmological constant to being hyperboloids at negative cosmological constant. And then this cusp occurs when you get up here and the trajectories go to this fixed point instead of this fixed point. Okay, so what does this have to do with Euclidean dynamical triangulations? Well, the setup of this particular line is quite similar to the way that people ran simulations of Euclidean dynamical triangulations, right? So first of all, they looked at four spheres, like we're doing here. And what they did was they fixed the volume of the four sphere, at least the number of four simplices going into the four sphere, and they varied this coupling constant kappa 2, right? And in all the simulations that people have run so far, they just found a first order phase transition. And because they only found a first order phase transition, they basically abandoned the model because it presumably doesn't admit a continuum limit, right? So what we're suggesting is that they should try running simulations at larger values of kappa 2, and they might encounter a second order phase transition corresponding to this point. That's the idea. Okay, so let me just wrap up. I just want to put up what I think are the key questions currently facing the causal dynamical triangulations approach. All right, so the first question is, right, whether or not causal dynamical triangulations admits a continuum limit in the form of an ultraviolet fixed point. So I personally would say that this is not a necessary condition for the viability of the approach, right? But if we didn't find a continuum limit, then most likely people will lose interest, I would say. Okay. So in order to address this question, I think there are a few things we need to do. We need numerical studies that are close to the second order transition between phases B and C, also close to this hypothetical triple point. And we should also explore whether or not the first order transition line ends at a second order point. Of course, those are the places where new simulations are hard to run, and that's why we haven't explored them yet. The other thing we really need to do is to find some good physical observables, more than we know about already. Right. The second question, which I haven't talked about at all, is whether or not causal dynamical triangulations has a Newtonian gravity limit. Right? Certainly, if it's going to be a quantum theory of gravity, it must have this limit. And with a student, Kyle Lee, I started to do a little bit of work that I can tell you about if you're interested, about one possible way to address this question. But it's quite hard, especially when you're just running simulations in Euclidean signature. All right. So I think the final question that we should really work on is that of whether or not we can formulate an Osterwalder-Schrader type theorem for causal dynamical triangulations. Right. We have all these results, some of which are quite nice, but they're all about numerical data in the Euclidean regime. Right. And for them to really have some force, we'd like to give them an interpretation that's Lorentzian. So I think there's some reasons to believe that we can formulate such a theorem. And I think a nice starting point would be this paper of Ashtekar et al. Thanks.
So, if there is any other question, I have questions about this point particle. So, you have
Yeah, so the
couple matter to...
So the idea was to basically construct a candidate point particle as sort of a bundle of quasi-local energy. So basically to take simplices as building blocks, construct something that classically has what we would call a positive quasi-local energy, sort of insert that into simulation and in a certain sense try to measure whether or not, well, if we inserted two of them, whether or not they attract in some sense an appropriate regime by the 1 over r squared law. That's the...
So this bundle, do they have defects, or what's the... Or it's... Do you have a way to model them?
So the... Okay, so to be a little more specific, the idea is that there's this known solution of the Einstein-Field equations due to... It's called the Bach-Weil solution, usually, where you have two point particles that you insist are held fixed at a fixed proper distance. The only way that you can hold them fixed at a fixed proper distance is for there to be a singularity between them. If you look at sort of just making a little loop around the singularity, you can basically read off the stress tensor around that loop. And what you find is that sort of to leading order, the stress on that singularity is precisely given by Newton's law. So the idea was to try to mimic that situation within one of these simulations. So there, you're right, so you need some notion of point particle. And so our initial idea was to make little, basically to make little sort of permanent defects in the triangulation and to hold them at a fixed distance apart as we run the simulation. And then to try to read off some information about the curvature along the line between those. That's the schematic idea, I would say. And so with the student...
What's the name of this solution again?
Bach-Weil.
It's in the book by...
By Singh.
Singh.
I think it's also in the book by Robertson.
It's an old, yeah.
It's a very old...
Okay. What this idea of using this singular solution?
Who?
Yeah.
That's basically Steve Carlop's idea.
Okay. That sounds like Carlop's idea. Okay.
Yeah, so that's a good question, right? So if there isn't a continuum limit, then at most causal dynamical triangulations would define an effective theory, right? But you know, many people would be happy enough if you had an effective theory. The question would be, does that effective theory incorporate any non-perturbative information, right? Is it any more than what you would just get by perturbatively quantizing Einstein gravity? So if it were an effective theory that happened to be to include some non-perturbative effects, that would seem like an improvement on what we have currently, even if it was only effective and didn't go up to a continuum limit at infinite energies. That's what I was thinking.
Will break down as
right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, except by the lattice spacing.
Yeah. Thanks, Josh, again.